Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Oh, hello, friends, and a pleasant Memorial Day to ye.
To ye.
And that other voice you hear is our producer extraordinaire, the third member of the team, Bryce Castillo.
I thought you were going to say the third wheel, and I was going to agree with that. Hi, everybody.
No,
welcome.
No.
Happy Memorial Day.
Bryce, you are the axle. You are the chassis upon which these wheels spin.
Yes. The chassis of our vehicle, our dream car, is Bryce.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I don't know if you've noticed that you could take Brian, Justin, or me out of the show.
Yeah.
And it runs. When you're not here, not so smooth.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. I'm flattered.
So, gentlemen, I'm really upset at Brian.
He's not even here.
I know.
Yeah, Brian,
why I'm upset.
Actually, can you go to the live shot of Brian?
Yeah, I mean, look at him. He's wasting away.
If there was ever a case for Spiro and the Fudge, it's this one coming up right now.
Oh no!
Oh, man.
Yeah,
all right,
but
well, I could try to do both.
Well, I could take Spiro. I could be.
You want a Spiro? You want a oh no? Or he?
I'll be
you the Fudge.
I think you're the Fudge.
I'm the Fudge.
I'll be Crash Bandicoot. The other Spyro. Never mind.
No, you could be like the second season replacement of Spiro.
Yeah.
So it could be, you know, Agnew.
Let's
Agnew.
Let's just invent similar archetypes with different names, like when Garfield had Heathcliff at the end. Like let's just give you the kind of the same thing but with slightly different flavors. So it'll be Sinclair and Sherbert. And I'll be Sherbert.
Okay. I'll be Sinclair. That's great.
All right. So gentlemen, got a problem.
All right.
I'm a Montana rancher, in case you haven't noticed, and I done shot something, and nobody there talks like that, but I'm just going to do that anyways. I shot something in my backyard, and I need your advice. It's why I called you in.
Oh, you shot? Well, are you worried about what you shot?
Oh,
hey,
yeah.
Whoa. Hold on. Sir, thank you for your comment. We'll be back in a second.
Oh, that's right. We
all
have
right.
To, yeah.
Sinclair.
What's up, Sherbert?
I think it's pretty obvious that this guy murdered somebody. So what do you say we just – let's just – right now, I want you to dial 9-1 on your phone.
Sure.
Or maybe even 9-1-1, right? And then just wait to hit
–
just
call
keep your
button.
Finger – like hand, phone in the pocket. Put your finger over where you're assuming the send button would be. All right.
Okay.
So take a second right now. Look at your phone. Memorize where the send button is. 911.
Got it right.
On the screen.
Hey. Just so you know, I think I may have murdered somebody.
Oh no, that's a confession too, Sherbert.
Not intentionally.
That's still manslaughter.
A likely story. All right. Just finger over the green button.
I got it.
All right, sir. You know, in all my years of sleuthing, I'm gonna try and blend in with him, Sinclair.
Okay.
Hey, y'all! In all my years of getting to the bottom of this haystack, I've found that there ain't no substituting a good eyeball. And why don't you say you reckon you bring that old carcass on over here so we might train our peepers on it?
Well, surely. But first, you need to know my backstory. You know, I decided to open up my own preserves, my own locally grown, you know, canned foods, things like this store in Williamsburg, you know, New York. But all those hipsters really got to me. I took all my LPs.
Town. Yeah.
You know, and my Klosterman novels, and I came out here to kind of get away from all of that. Like, ugh. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Yeah. Certainly so, I reckon.
Yeah, and I do three podcasts a day, too, by the way. You know, one on denim. It's really, really good. You should check that out.
Oh, I should.
The locals, you'd think they'd be more into a denim podcast, but...
I mean, that's no culture. Salt to the earth. God don't make them like they made us anymore, huh?
True.
Always ignoring flyover country.
Yeah, it's a shame.
Main
it's a shame
Street,
to try to show
Wall
people
Street,
their culture.
Right, my brother? All right.
Minding my own business, you know, outside here reading Harper's and with my shotgun across my lap.
Sure.
And then I saw something kind of disturbing, you know, something that was coming at me. And I'm thinking, oh, maybe it's that person I had that flame war with on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I mean, really, if you want to make your own statement about a corduroy jacket, that's fine. But I'm going to tell you that you're wrong, that you're very, very wrong. And I was reading the latest think piece in Huffington Post, too, which really got me kind of in an agitated mood. And I saw this thing coming forward me, and I was worried for my personal protection. Now, I'm against guns, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely against guns. But for my own personal protection, I do have one.
Sure. I mean, you've got to have
I'm not happy with
one.
That contradiction.
Sure.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, we all, when we look into the mirror that is life, sometimes our reflection is a bit askew. And I take a piece of straw and I put it in my mouth and I try to angle myself against the sun so I can light a cigarette like the Marlboro Man.
You understand what I'm saying. So anyhow, you never know. Like, the locals here haven't quite been receptive to me. Maybe it's because of my subscription to The Atlantic. I'm not quite sure, you know. I was afraid for my life. I fired into the trees. And then I found this.
Wow.
All right. Well, it appears, you know, if I'm to be drawn.
Let me look up this tarp here, by the way. I made it myself from hemp.
Sorry, one more time?
I'm lifting my hemp tarp to show you the body.
It's the hemp tarp.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. Sinclair, huddle up real quick before we get this reveal.
Sinclair, you have the image ready, right?
Yes.
If I'm to be believed here... Oh, wait, I can drop the accent. Jeez.
Yeah, you're good at that accent. Are you groundlings?
Can you believe how dumb these rubes are from out here in the sticks?
Jeez. Williamsburg!
All right.
We know where you hang your hat, sir. We're having a huddle.
I mean, come on.
You need my trucker hat? I got 20 just like it.
Williamsburg is so 10 years ago. It might as well be Montana.
That's why I left...
All right.
Please, sir. This is supposed to be a huddle.
So, it seems as if that this hipster immigré got himself all riled up reading Harper's Bazaar, mm-hmm. and amongst all the frightening tales of climate change and constitutional crises and whatnot, he got a little trigger happy and might have murdered somebody trying to. I don't know, maybe getting them on the publisher's clearinghouse or solicit a donation for a local wildlife preserve.
Yeah, well, he seems so unsure of it is the only thing. I mean, he has a hemp tarp. He's, I guess, sewn a very nice hemp tarp. You'd think he'd be someone who is acute of detail.
Hmm. Well, did you know that hemp would have been made more legal if it weren't for the DuPont Corporation lobbying the government.
Okay, now, Sherbert, we don't need to get into your hemp rant.
I'm just saying. stronger than most fibers that's commercially available. It would have totally destroyed the industry. Let's go ahead. All right.
Let's take
a
look.
Do me a favor and 3, 2, 1, move that tarp.
Now, before I move it, I should warn you that ever since John Voight moved in the neighborhood, I really have felt that Williamsburg really is in decline.
Okay. Here's what's under the tarp. Oh, my goodness. I mean, this looks like this just looks like a big dog.
Werewolf.
Well, I mean, so it appears this is a gigantic, either like a dog or it almost looks like kind of dire wolf size, like from Game of Thrones. Like it bigger than a regular wolf, like almost big enough that a human could ride on it.
Mm-hmm. I don't see any eyes. You would think from this angle you should at least see part of an eye, or at least like the flap of a closed eye.
There are eyes if you go look to the keep moving.
Oh, on the other left side of the tarp? Sure, sure, sure.
No, no. Yeah, there are eyes. You're just looking at the wrong angle.
Yeah. So.
Well, it appears, sir, that you shot a wolf for a dog. Case closed.
So, what we're looking at is
holy
a very
crap,
strange,
this thing is gigantic.
It's his paw is about the size of like the central part of this guy of this gentleman's palm, the sans digits. Huge.
That's gigantic.
So the story on this was a rancher near the town of Denton killed the animal on May 16th when it ventured within several hundred yards of his livestock. He then reported to the Fish and Wildlife and Parks in accordance with the law. Now, because it was close to his house and his animals, he was within his rights to shoot it. Wolves are native to the area, so that's what they thought it was at first. But then the department's wolf experts looked at the photos of it, and they're like, something's not right about the animal, quote, a spokesman for the department said in a video. It does not look like a wild wolf.
Well, what's beyond wolf? I mean, if he was saying that it
beyond wolf show title.
Yeah. Ooh, baby, that's not a wild wolf.
I mean, if
it hasn't stopped the internet from speculating, yeah. The cryptic community is about the possibility of a dog man or a dog woman.
Oh.
Or an extinct member of the direwolf species. You know, those sober, analytical, objective loving people in the cryptid communities.
I mean, it almost looks like I don't know if it's just because its fur is really dirty and matted, but it almost looks like a bear a little bit. I guess that could be.
Bryce says wolf bear hybrid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is also dogs are, in general, really the like most valuable player of the cryptid world, right? Because dogs get mangy and hairless and they look like a million different things. So if this is not a wolf, what makes it not a wolf, I guess, according to the experts?
So for people saying, have they heard of DNA? Yeah, it's not like movies or TV like CSI where they're like, oh, we'll just DNA test this right now. In the real world, things take time. You have to send samples off to laboratories and, you know, can take a while to do that.
Especially
so
for like,
they're doing DNA testing.
Yeah. Just to give you a sense, in stories that I've covered where deaths are involved and toxicology reports are taken to determine the cause of death, that can very regularly take over a month and a half. Like, this is not something where you just swab a mouth and you know, enter it into an app and then it spits it right back at you. Like, these lab testings, because they want to be sure, oftentimes take a long time.
So I hope I'm not jumping the gun in this article here, Andrew, but they're saying that this would not be the first wolf-dog hybrid that they've had in this area.
So it could – that's the theory, is that it could be a wolf and some species of dog and it's a hybrid. That's probably the best theory. And they've had wolf-dog hybrids that then, you know, they eat their sheep, whatever. They're hungry and they just go out there and do their thing. So that could be what it is that it's, you know, some sort of hybrid of that. Probably the most likely.
Or
wolf-human hybrid, you know.
This is from sciencealert.com. Dog-wolf hybrids are mainly produced in captivity and are supposed to be registered with a tattoo since they can be unpredictable. Although it's rare because wolves are so territorial, this kind of crossbreed could occur in the wild. Wow. I guess I never figured that if you were getting into the hybridization game, you would have to essentially brand the offspring because it would need to be identified quickly.
Yeah, because a wolf-dog hybrid looks remarkably a lot like a wolf, you know, on first glance, is you want to make sure that, like, if somebody shoots it, whatever, you're able to, like, oh, this was a hybrid or whatever, we can identify this, you know, if you catch it or whatever, because do you have a wolf or do you have a dog wolf?
Right.
Holy crap. So what would you do if you – I mean, I guess you'd be pretty pumped that you shot it, right? Like that thing looks like it's a killer.
Strap that to the front of my Volvo and drive all around town.
It looks like one of those wild ass animals that, you know, you would take off its head and coat and wear it around for the wild rumpus.
It looks
like a prop from like a werewolf movie where they'd kind of like, yeah, I guess it works. It's not quite wolf-like, guys. It looks a little too thick around the neck. And the we won't linger on the shot.
This is their first try at the
yeah.
Yeah, it's big enough that you could even make like a small like runner, like a small carpet, a little rug out of it. Like not a full size like a bear.
Bryce, I want you from now on. The meme on this show has to be you describing all animals by how big of a rug they'd be able to make. Okay. Like I'm just talking about like maybe bathroom mat to full room rug.
Sure. Well, if you ask me, I think this one is probably a little runner, something you'd put in the foyer. to greet people, but it's not ostentatious.
It's not a showpiece per se. It's just a nice little accent.
Yeah. Wow. So they have no idea yet of what this thing is, but I guess we might know soon.
I think once they do DNA, you know, that will resolve it. But it's, you know, while you wait for the DNA, it becomes the mystery game of what are we looking at.
I also wonder how much they have in their budget to DNA test stuff. You know, like a Fish and Wildlife.
That is kind of a routine. DNA testing is what they do a lot now in poaching and other things like this. Oh. And it's one of the it's a thing that they do. They work with certain labs to be able to do that. But
this is here. It may be months before they get an answer for it. So it could be a thing where, you know, they can afford to do it, but there's no need to rush it because the thing's already dead.
I'm going to send you this is a graphic we've used before. I don't know if you guys remember this, but I'm going to send this to you, Bryce, because I want to show you that one of the problems in trying to categorize things like this, particularly if you get hybrids and stuff, it makes it even more complicated. And if you want to throw that up on the screen.
Sure. We're looking at these look like.
Don't call what they are.
Okay.
And we're going to keep that. All right. Justin, take a look there.
Uh-huh.
How closely related would you say those species were?
Wow, I mean, they look almost identical. You know, there's maybe like a few differences in some of the contours of the bones. We're looking at a skull in different angles from it, but the top-down angles look almost identical, and the teeth structure looks similar. I would say that these are closely related, very, very closely related animals.
So what we're looking at, and again, you know, it's to show you, this is just looking at bones. And that's one of the problems that going back and having only one factor to look at an animal to try to understand the difference to. One on the right is a wolf, timber wolf. The one on the left is a Tasmanian tiger, a thylacine, okay, or Tasmanian wolf, which is a marsupial, okay?
What? Now, oh, geez.
Marsupials separated from, you know, the same, our ancestors as far as the line and the different mammalian lines, you know, that's like 30 million years ago. Okay.
But these look remarkably similar in these various skull fragments.
We're more closely related to the wolf on the right. We are more closely related to the wolf on the right.
Humans are.
Horses are more close. Dolphins, you know. You know, remember, dolphins, we're more closely related to a dolphin than a wolf is to that thing on the left.
Wow.
Wow.
And that's because what happened is, you know, when we had that branch and that mammal branch, marsupials, they think, you know, mammals with pouches and mammals without pouches, you know, split apart. Everything that we have going back to that point that don't have a pouch or whatever, you know, we have a share common ancestors with. Yet because the Tasmanian wolf and the timber wolf, we use the same term wolf interchangeably because they look alike, but they are, evolutionary speaking, tens of millions of years apart. But what happened was they adapted to very similar environments, similar like heights of grass, trying to find little prey. There are marsupial versions of, like, you know, mice and rats that they would hunt. And so they hunted the same creatures. They had very, very same environments, but slightly different, yet they evolved to look a lot alike. You know, it's like deer and kangaroo. You know, kangaroo and deer morphologically are very different, but they fill similar niches.
Hmm.
And they're large, big nuisances, you know, to some people.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Wow.
So, you know, convergent evolution is very interesting, where you look at something that's like, how did this thing happen? You know, and you roll back the, you know, the clock back in time, change things up a little bit differently and completely different results. But sometimes things fail. You see that in the ocean a lot. You see, you know, species mimicry is one thing where something tries to look like something else, but other times it's just, it solves the same problem.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what's not a nuisance. You guys supporting us on patreon.com/weirdthings. That is where you can go ahead and kick us a few dollars. Make sure that we keep the weird flowing. And if you are a patron, well, guess what, man? You're going to get your own audio RSS link. That's something that you can plug right into the podcatcher of your choice. You use the Apple podcatcher. You use the Google one. You use any of the private ones. It's just so easy. You hit add, and then you just paste in that RSS feed, and boom, not only do you get directly the first possible feed of our podcast, but also you get After Things, which we do after Weird Things, where we talk about creativity and business and all sorts of other stuff that I think a lot of people who dig this show really get a big kick out of. So join us, won't you? Patreon.com/weirdthing.
And I think it's understated how easy it is to use this RSS link. You know, a lot of times if you get a private one, you have to like log in and you have to have a, like on your podcatcher, it has to be built to like log you into private RSS feeds. This is a bespoke link that is only for you. You don't have to worry about logging in, which is a
pain in the butt.
It's a real like, pain. So
super easy. Just copy. It's literally, you can do it on your mobile phone. Like, you just copy that link and paste it right into the app. You don't need to worry about nothing.
That's right.
Gentlemen, let's talk about something maybe we do have to worry about.
Uh-oh.
AI can't solve everything.
What? No, why not?
Well,
can it solve a lonely heart?
Can it rank the best ice cream flavors at TCBY?
Well, no, and I'm going to tell you why. There's a paper that came out in The Conversation, and it's been reprinted elsewhere by Vyacheslav Polonsky from the University of Oxford, and he's making this claim like, hey, there's a lot of excitement about AI, you know, like AI is going to do this, AI is going to do that, and he's like, hey, settle down, everybody. AI can't do everything. And he's pointed out like, hey, you know, they tried to use algorithms in courts to help with sentencing. They found out that it amplified structural racial indiscrimination. Okay. Mm-hmm. He shows, you know, lists some other examples where AI was supposed to help, but it didn't, it failed.
And that's
you know,
a case of
Facebook tried to use it, you know, to prevent the spread of misinformation, and it failed.
And that's a lot of a case of it extrapolating on reported outcomes and not necessarily ideal outcomes or ideal structures, right? I mean, I would assume that it, in terms of like the judicial system one, where if it's basing it off of history and not the ideal outcome of say objective justice.
Well, yeah, and I don't know that resolution, you know, what they had, what came out of there, I don't know that it's not debatable as far as was it better or worse than, but the article makes a point that in one way I would say that like, well, yeah, of course it can't do everything now because you've got to ask the right questions and have the right data. If you don't have the right data, like a human trying to make decisions, some people are going to be better than others because they have more information or they're better at using it. And I think that was sort of the thing that kind of the article didn't really get into. And sort of you hear there's another book came out, MIT Press released this one, and this woman's talking about like, hey, technology's not everything we thought it was supposed to be, and I prefer to fill out a form by hand kind of thing. And it's like, I don't. But you get this sort of like, hey, it hasn't solved everything yet. It's like, well, yeah, it doesn't work.
We're not a
failure. Well, my car can't make me a cup of espresso, so throw it in the garbage.
Yeah, and I think that it's brings up it's sort of this point where you have this exciting promise of a technology. The problem is the technology is not this isolated thing that one day it arrives and it solves all the problems. It's how you use a thing. There's a lot of amazing things we can do with computers and computation, but we're not doing them. And often too, you know, we've talked about this before, you know, like, well, Facebook was trying to use AI to filter stuff. Like, well, one, it's Facebook trying to solve the problem, and to what end? Facebook tries to create posts or promote posts that will get you to interact more with Facebook. But if Facebook says, oh yeah, the best way to do this is to get rid of 90% of the things our algorithm wants you to look at, not a good solution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and it also creates what I think we're seeing a lot of now, which is people bristling at posts being auto-removed or accounts being kind of shadow banned, like, so things don't appear as they would otherwise because it's flagged as troubling or problematic. And ultimately, I think we're driving at kind of the same point of, hey, look, these things are, again, they're only as good. These are only as good as we are able to feed it data. Like this is at this point with all these AI advancements, they are only as good as our cooperation with them in determining what we want it to solve and how we are going about solving it, and really what we want out of it. Because that's another thing is, like, you know, a lot of times when we talk about, specifically to go back to the social media example, the drive get bad things off our platform seems simple, right? But we all know that that is far more complicated to do than we would think. You know, it's not what is bad to some is not bad to others.
And what's tough about machine learning, assuming that we're kind of folding machine learning as a term into this, is that it needs a lot of live data. I mean, YouTube's been messing up a lot lately, quote unquote messing up, because their algorithm is working live. It is constantly making adjustments to what is and isn't promoted, what is and isn't shown to people. And you have to have these live reactions so that you can get real responses and outcomes from users and the developers.
Well, that's a very good example, because, like, I'll get, like, YouTube will recommend check this out, and they're complete garbage. And garbage to me because, oh, this frame grab for this next video is a girl in a bikini, and they know, like, hey, he likes girls, let's throw this here. And then it's this other thing, this you know, the five things about Elon Musk you don't blink, and it's this clickbaity whatever kinds of things, because YouTube's goal, like Facebook, is we want you to stay in there and keep watching stuff. And so we're going to try to poke you. We're going to try to poke your little neurons. We're going to try to find that thing that gets you to respond. And that's the business model. I get it. That's what they're supposed to do. But then it's this, now, you know, they had a problem where it looked like, you know, appeared to be that YouTube was, like, you know, you would start off with, you know, one sort of outside of center point of view on a video, and then it recommends another one. And then 20 videos later, you're like, wow, maybe I should sign up for ISIS, you know?
It would keep pushing you further and further to the extremes.
Yeah, exactly. That they look at how it can, and it could very easily let people. And, you know, I think the big problem came into is it's the algorithm. Is the, you know, once we got into this algorithm sort of thing that was designed to keep you there, to keep you in the system, it's when things got out of control. And it's why we're asking. I think the idea of us, you know, these giants trying to police content is stupid, because it's a horrible idea. But I also thought that the algorithm was counterintuitive. I stopped using Twitter as much when it went to algorithm. I stopped using Instagram as much because we talked about this before the show. It's disorienting to me, and it's not what I want out of it, but other people's engagement more than made up for that. Yeah. But once they got into the algorithm manipulation, the algorithm became the content. You know, we're going to decide what content to put in front of you, and now we're kind of responsible if we put bad stuff in front of you, and now they're getting attacked for that.
And I feel like I'm the type of person, especially in the example of Instagram or other social media platforms, I have a principle, I guess, to want all of my stuff to be chronological and to just the things that I, you know, choose to subscribe to. But I find also that on the flip side, a lot of times I hit the end of anything that's new and I want to see something new. And that means, you know, going to the Explore tab on Tumblr or going to the homepage on Twitter and seeing what people like. And kind of what happens is what they want to happen is where you click on it and you don't realize that you don't even realize until after you've seen the tweet that you like it, that it's not even from someone you follow.
That's what frustrating for me, like with YouTube, is I want to watch like tutorials on coding, and they'll list, like Google will list, here's all the videos. They don't show me the ratings.
Yeah.
I have to click through and then go, oh, this has got garbage ratings. People keep clicking on the headlines and watching the first 15 seconds and getting the pre-roll. And it's that the conversation, they have to police content. Like, yeah, you need to police to make sure something's not illegal. But once we step outside of that and we go, well, this is hate speech ain't in the Constitution. It's not there. They never would have put a mention of that in there, because the problem is how do you define it? You know, where there's a big case right now in England where, you know, a far right anti-immigration advocate is been arrested, put in jail. Because he was covering a trial involving, you know, gangs of men who are accused of raping young women. And they happen to predominantly are the Muslim gangs. And have you heard about this case going on?
Yeah.
There's a complete blackout in the UK for the, like, on the guy's name and everything else going around. And there's, you know, the questions legality, like there's a judge said you can't talk about this case because it might prejudice jurors and all that. And there's question, you know, there's a debate to be had about, like, you know, should we do that in criminal justice system or not, whatever.
It says super gag orders. Is that right?
Something like that, which sounds scary to me, but I'm open to hearing the explanations for that before I go on my knee jerk.
Europe has and the UK specifically has notoriously, I would say, authoritarian laws about free speech in the press. Like there are they do not enjoy the freedom of just being able to run stuff and then letting the merits of it be laid at the foot of like being malicious or anything like that. Like the government can just say you're not reporting on this and you can just be made to not report it.
Yeah.
But oddly enough, there's the one place where you can absolutely say anything you want is
the internet.
No, I mean in the UK.
In the UK?
Parliament.
Parliament.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can say anything you want there, but provided that you are, you know, a politician, you have that. But that's like that's the one place where sort of the free speech boundaries or the limitations on speech stop is in there. As you can say whatever you want, which is sort of like, I'm not from there. I have no say in the politics there or whatever. I find that frustrating. And, you know, the issues here, I'm hearing it through, you know, people repeating it over here, what's going on there. My point, though, is it comes back to, is it like, it's very easy for people to say, hey, on one hand, we have a very, in the United States, you know, we have a very kind of this free speech is free speech. Unless you say something that is, you know, objectively not true about somebody, then it's a civil matter, not a criminal matter. Mm-hmm. You know, Europe's got some sketchy laws. I think Canada's too, that I don't, you know, again, people from there, works for you, that's fine. If you're the person who doesn't want to say things that are outrageous. But, you know, we're having this problem here because we talk about policing, like, and we go, do we police to the extent of the law, or do we police to what we think is, it hurt somebody's feelings, or I'm, you know, being mean to a group.
When a lot of it, especially in YouTube's case, which we've seen already in the past 12 months or so, is that advertisers are scared. And further in from the limitations of, say, the U.S. Constitution, they also want to appease advertisers and make it so that advertisers can click a button and say, either give me these definitely safe stuff, or I am okay with racy stuff. I'm okay with something even harder than that. And
I think the problem that YouTube wound up facing is that they very much defended their idea that they were only selling demographics, right? And they were only going to sell to allow certain channels for advertisers and punish, if not kind of outlaw or restrict, the abilities for creators to go out themselves and say, no, I want to sell, you know, full access of my channel to X, Y, or Z, right? Like, that is hard to do. YouTube has put in, like, you know, I don't remember. I don't know the latest. I'm sure, Bryce, you're more up to date on like what they're like. You can't have more than two like promos or whatever, like in your video, if you're also taking their ad dollars.
Yeah, I don't know the exact rules on it, but I do know that YouTube is a very complicated beast on the back end in terms of like, you know, well, certain large channels or corporate channels are allowed to sell their own ads and are able to somehow plug that into YouTube to say, hey, serve these instead of this. But as far as the rules on it, you know, from what I know, at least the rule over a year or so ago was that you really weren't supposed to put your own ads into videos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You if you were using, you know, YouTube AdSense or the partner program, whatever, you were not allowed to do that. And,
oh, wow. So you can't say inside the ad. Well, I mean, but you guys have ads for like Audible and HelloFresh on Modern Road,
well,
right?
Well, and that's the thing of it is that used to be the rule. I mean, if you go back to Scam School, there were certainly at least a time period during Scam School's run on YouTube or continued on where this rule did exist that said you weren't allowed to sell space inside of your video. And whether it's because Scam School was, say, an MCN a channel that was controlled by a network or what, the general rule was, and I think still is, and maybe it's just a paper rule and everyone's ignoring it, is that you're not supposed to really sell ad time and sort of skirt all of these monetization things, which is what YouTube was afraid of. But now, you know, we continue to sell ads on these videos, and now YouTube has a checkbox that says, hey, does this video include product placement? And we say, yes, it does, because it does. And when you watch it, and this is a new thing over the past, say, 6 months or so, when you start a video that has that thing checkmarked, you'll actually see on it, it includes product placement, which is kind of a weird thing. But, you know, when it's the start of the video and it's the guys saying, hey, this is sponsored by a domain, then that totally tracks. That's not an issue. So I think it's a thing that is technically a rule, but I don't know that YouTube is.
I guess beyond the specifics, you know, YouTube and a lot of these platforms have gotten themselves into trouble where I think a lot of the core elements of their platform that they've allowed to kind of overgrow and haven't made hard decisions on earlier now create larger, more explosive problems where, you know, YouTube found a place where they had gigantic groups of advertisers in revolt because stories were coming out that, you know, you were getting a Clorox bleach ad on an ISIS beheading video.
Yeah.
Right. And that to me is these are all things that they made decisions to let kind of unfurl to the point where they had to make decisions that they might not have been happy about when the chips were down and advertisers were saying, no, listen, we're going to pull money back from advertising on these platforms. And that's hard. Those are not optimal decisions to make.
And it's not,
people are looking to walk away from your platform that you have to make, oh, healthy audience based decisions that keep people happy on your platform. It's rarely is it like, oh, when a gun was to my head, I made the healthy decision.
Well, and the other tough thing is that in terms of online video, Google is in uncharted territory, right? There's no other video site, and there probably hasn't ever been one that has so much market share, is at such a huge scale and is integrated into such a high-tech company like Google that everyone, I think everyone has the expectation that Google can or must fix all of the issues. And it's a very hard situation, I think. I bet they can, but I don't know what the answers are.
I'll say here's the complicating part of this was Google succeeded over Yahoo because Google said, hey, instead of having your advertising managers be people who handle this like a magazine and do ad sales and say only call us if you have more than $10,000 a month to spend, Google came up with a computational solution to it, you know, with AdSense, which was the idea in AdWords, which is the idea that, you know, you say, I got $12 a month to spend. And Google's like, yeah, we can make a profit on that, you know, because it's all a machine. There's no human there handling that.
Yeah.
And Google built its empire based upon the idea of, hey, if we're in the age of the internet and computers, why not use computers to solve these problems? And so when it came to running auctions and doing things like that and ad sales and doing content analysis in a plot in a blog or news article to figure out what ad to run, it was pretty good and good enough. Now, as they became a main distributor for content, as you went to Google to go to YouTube to watch videos, and they became this primary source of content or distributor of content, it got more complicated because now we're saying, no, we don't want this ad to go with this video. But the problem is the only way to know what this video is about is to have a human watch it. And you know, one of the reasons Google's been spending a lot of effort in trying to do transcription isn't just to help people who are hard of hearing. It's so they know what's in the video itself. But still, that's a big challenge. And that's the problem Facebook faces, is that Facebook could have this – all they had to know at the post was like, hey, if we showed this to five of Bryce's friends, they all clicked on it. Let's show it to all 50 of – you have more friends than that. You know, let's show it to all of Bryce's friends, sure, and we will promote this post. It doesn't care what it is because it doesn't need to know. The algorithm can be quite dumb as far as the content itself. It can pick up some keywords or things like this, and that scales wonderfully because you write one piece of code and you can replicate it for millions, for a billion users. But once people are like, oh no, this video is horrible, it's hate speech, it's this, then it's like, well, why did you do this, Facebook? And there was the assumption that there's people there going, yeah, post this, raise this, put this there. Wasn't. Was a machine. Now we're like, you've got to solve this problem. Well, it's a damn hard problem to solve. Very, very hard to solve because they pointed out in that article before, AI can't solve everything. Like, well, not at the moment. But presently, yeah, it's really hard to know. Is this is an Al Jazeera post talking about, you know, a problem in Syria, you know, regular news versus something that's an ISIS recruiting video, which, you know, to the casual observer might seem similar, but actually are radically different and totally different sides of the spectrum, but they have on the surface a lot of the same features. Oh, there's Arabic, there's violence.
And you know, I think a lot of it goes back to an issue of scale. Even if Facebook or YouTube create the perfect or not perfect, create the most ideal or most effective version of this algorithm, It is those companies are so large that the people that will be caught in it, that will be caught in the fringes of it, will still be sizable enough where it will be a no win. It will be hard to claim anything will be a victory because of how impossibly large both of those companies are.
Absolutely. And you know, the problem they had early on was like Facebook said, you know, we'll have a team of people who go through and so the bigger posts and we'll decide. And then, hey, they recruited a bunch of people and contractors in the Bay Area to decide, you know, what's to one extreme or the other. And guess what? Some people thought that it was a bit biased.
Yeah,
that's right.
In Facebook's case, what, it was like 10 unemployed writers in Brooklyn that they put into a warehouse so they could determine, you know, trending topics that were too racy or not sufficient. And turns out when you put a bunch of unemployed writers from Brooklyn into a warehouse, that politically, if there was a slant, it was that conservative stories wound up getting taken down more than liberal stories wound up getting taken down.
And that newsroom, if you even want to call it a newsroom, technically was only around for a couple of months. I mean, none of those people were full time. All of those people were contractors. Mm-hmm. All the people who came out and spoke about it said, yeah, we were thrown in a closet and then were tossed out one day.
And it shows you that, you know, we here were like, well, this is doomed to fail because of this. But you know, now, as we've talked about this before, Google with the selfish ledger is, you know, an internal project there that got a lot of attention and, you know, and now got some criticism because it turned out that they didn't get clearances to use some of the images and video there.
The stock footage,
is that, you know, we're expecting these people who run these empires because they run these billion-dollar empires. Well, God, they got to be universally smart. They got to be smart all around. Turns out, no, they're smart at a couple things, and they hire people who are smart in some of those same things. And we've seen there is not a lot of tolerance for very different ideological points of view, and not even say that people with different points of view, but people who can at least articulate that in some of these situations. And that causes problems because then you're like, who would have saw that coming? I don't know. Maybe if we had people from different points of view, we would have.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's where I think when you get into the conversation of hate speech, there is a, to me, step one of determining an effective filter for keeping speech, and let's just even define hate speech right now as something that is objectionable to 80% of your user base, right? Mm-hmm. Something that, like, when the vast majority sees it, they're like, oh God, no, like, I don't, that's not appropriate. You have to understand where that 80% is, right? Like, what, mm-hmm. what is that tie that binds and that will bind beyond ideology, that will bind beyond politics, right? Like, you know, I think there is a line between, all right, here's somebody laughing hysterically over, you know, lynching footage, and somebody that is articulating a political opinion that is not in, you know, that is a fringe, right? But is just somebody talking about it. Where do we categorize that? And, like, I don't say that in a way that I think that, you know, people can just Thanos snap their fingers and make it happen. Because I do think, like Andrew pointed out, when so much of this is algorithm based and so much of this is computational, it's hard to figure out what those things are. And as they are now, specifically YouTube, if we're going to keep on that, they are post one advertiser revolt. You can understand that now they are going to be more draconian than they would be if, let's say, this was an internal crisis of conscience 5 years ago, that they were like, all right, we have to take some unpopular steps to safeguard ourselves for the future. Now they're like, no, we have to cut this off way further than we would have otherwise, because now we are, you know, we're over the barrel if people have already attempted to pull their money out once.
Yeah, in some ways, it's trying to put, put the genie back in the bottle. It's trying to sort of put things back in there, and it's problematic. And I don't think there is, as Bryce pointed out, a solution that's going to be happy towards for everybody. There's going to be people who are going to be excluded there. And, you know, we can't even agree because, you know, we have points of view in our own discussion room here about, like, what's OK and what's not OK. You know, like, is it, you know, when is speech OK? When is it not OK? What is the responsibility of a platform? And you have, in Justin's point out, in YouTube's case, you have advertisers that, like, we like this, we don't like this, and we don't want to be associated with this. But then you have so much. You look at Google, you know, talks about how many hours of content are uploaded to YouTube, like, every day now.
I mean,
average lifetime of everybody every day.
It's like a year of content a day or something like that. Like, multiple hours every hour.
Let me load uploaded here. Sure. Let me go. YouTube content uploaded every minute. From 2018, 300 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube every minute.
Wow.
Jesus.
That's incredible.
That's a lot of hooch.
And
I have so much to catch up on. Jeez.
I know. It's.
What am I doing? Oh, wait, I'm making content. I'm part of the problem.
Get to watching.
So that's like 18,000 minutes an hour.
I think it also, I would not, I think on the end of this road, whether it's appeasing advertisers or curbing, say, hate speech or objectionable content.
Wait, I'm sorry. That's 18,000 hours every hour.
18,000 hours every hour?
Yeah. 300 hours a minute.
18,000 hours of content.
That's crazy.
Yeah, 300 hours every minute times 60 is 18,000 of hours of content every single hour. Okay.
1,800. So, no, you're right. 18,000. Wow.
Yeah. So times 24. So 500,000 hours a day. So what team do you put in charge of policing that? Taiwan?
Yeah, right.
I think at the end of this, the Google and Facebook will not be sad that they've had to invent this technology, whatever it is, to determine more accurately what is in the content of a video, because they are, at the end of the day, whether they're trying to appease advertisers, they are also trying to keep people on their service. And if they have a better sense of, okay, well, this is what type of content in it, and this is what sort of things you see in it, and this is in a near future scenario, this is the quality of that content, we are they would only be better able to ramp up their recommendation engines.
So, yes, when you get there, I agree. The problem is when you were looking at 500,000 hours of content a day, one, you need to have the model that's able to do that, which has to be an extremely, and from my belief would have to be something that's a very, very adept AI that's very understanding where something falls in the spectrum, what have you, you know, and we've heard the problem we have is there's a fundamental lack of understanding in the media and a lot of critics about this, like, oh, they should have people filtering this. It's like, how do you filter 500,000 hours a day of content? And nobody, like, you're like, well, maybe we should have as much. Like, no, that's not the answer, you know? Yeah. And then it's,
yeah.
And you get like Facebook, you know,
figure in that dig.
Yeah. Facebook now is something like 10,000 people or something who are trying to filter it, whatever. And it's like,
and by the way, so by those numbers, 18,000 hours, that means that every hour there are 750 24-hour days worth of content that are uploaded to YouTube. That, by the way, is over 2 years. 2 years worth of content if you were to do nothing but watch YouTube, uploaded per hour.
And the thing to think about, too, is that you can say, like, well, they should just hire more people. The problem is that average hour of content would never make back what you're paying somebody to watch the whole thing and review it. You will never get that money back, because that, if it costs you $20 an hour to hire somebody to do it, that video is never going to make $20 in its entire lifetime.
Sure. Though I do think that YouTube, and YouTube has done this before, can work from the top down and give that level of service to the high and mid tier creators who constantly are getting into, who are constantly having to get into kerfuffles. Oh, someone claimed my thing. It's taken days for anyone to look at this thing that is clearly okay.
Agreed. But the problem is that you get the bulk of the content that covers 3% of the content that's on YouTube. 97% of it are these videos that get less than 100 views or whatever.
Sure.
But you get 1,000 of these videos uploaded under different you know, names that are using these computer algorithms to generate content and stuff or to be controversial. And that's the problem is that I don't know how you do it. And I think that it's a problem they created. And we're talking about people like they're not too sympathetic towards Google or Facebook. Nah, I'm with you. It's a problem they largely created. The algorithm was designed to take content, get you to watch more regardless, and I'll even say irregardless, just Ooh. Because I want to be irrational, regardless of what it is and the effect of that. And that's fine. That's a choice they get to make. Mm-hmm. But there is a price to pay down the line, which is if you create this platform that all of a sudden people become very, very unhappy with some of the things on it. And also you have the problem, too. It's like we tend to be very unhappy with the stuff that we disagree with. Not the stuff that we agree with, because you'll hear a lot of people like, you shouldn't be able to harass or this or whatever. It's like, how many people that you follow on Twitter harass people that you don't like or say things that are very negative or very much like this, but it doesn't trip your, hey, this is wrong because, well, that person is bad. That person is wrong and it's okay.
Mm-hmm. So fine line between harassment and a awesome dunking on when it comes to social media.
Yeah. Watch so-and-so totally get served up here. And you're like, do I like the part of me that likes that?
Well, and then and this is all like, then you get into the satirical or comedic or creative takes on all of this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Which is all right. There's a guy I follow on Twitter who I think is pretty funny, who got temporarily locked out of Twitter for like a week. Because he said something inflammatory, and it was very obviously a joke, but also he followed it up with a tweet saying, this is not a joke. And it clearly was, but that's a computer won't know that.
Well, I wouldn't doubt if that goes to somebody that, you know, puts a human that rubber stamps that. Sure. Yeah, but it's like, if all you get is this context and you don't know that it's like, you know, this is a satirical thing. Like they take into account like a pixelated boat. Right. Mm-hmm. Who does a comic and oftentimes ventures into the political. But you might know him as the author of the Gorilla Channel pages from the Fire and Fury book, where a lot of the stuff that he does is he'll just say, like, I can't believe this. And then it'll be a photoshopped either tweet or and the Gorilla Channel thing was during. Yeah. So this is example, like, what a strange tweet. And it's Donald Trump's Twitter. It's a screen grab. Happy Memorial Day. Those who died for our great country would be very happy and proud at how well our country is doing today. Everybody loves Raymond canceled. Ray Romano dead. Happy Easter. So, like, that's somebody that obviously is a satirical person, right? A satirical account. But if he says this thing that gets flagged, right? It's users that are flagging this as inappropriate. It then goes to somebody who only sees the two things that are mentioned. And if those two things are, I'm going to kill the president and this is not a joke, then, like, boom. Like, that's yeah. What else do we want from a human objective authority? Like, it's not their job to go back into the history and say, well, clearly this person has a fancy for the whimsy. Let's let him off. Like, now that gives you carte blanche to say, I'll kill the president. This isn't a joke.
Sure. And it wasn't even I'm going to kill the president. It's like,
sure.
What was it? Hillary Clinton should get run over by a monster truck or something like that. Something yeah. like. On a whimsical twinge to it, but there's
according to the popular vote, that's I'm going to kill the president.
The stuff he's done before is hilarious. Like that you mentioned, like the whole Gorilla Channel thing was absolutely brilliant. Because I remember reading that, I'm like, oh, this is great, this is beautiful, this is like just wonderful parody, and then. You watched it get circulated because people believed it. And
so, yeah, for those of you who don't know, when Fire and Fury came out, which was a very short runway, it kind of became obviously a gigantic viral sort of sensation.
A book about the president, Trump's presidency.
All these inside sources of the tumultuous opening days and final days of the campaign of the Trump campaign in the White House, right? And so Pixelated Bone did this hilarious thing about how Donald Trump was furious that in the White House they didn't have the Gorilla Channel, which he demanded was 24 hours of gorillas fighting each other. And then so they made a loop of gorilla footage, but he was upset because it was boring because there wasn't always gorillas fighting. So they edited out all of the documentaries where gorillas weren't fighting. And they said that he watches the Gorilla Channel for 17 hours straight.
It's a hilarious because it's like you take the thing like that our president likes to watch Shark Week and extrapolate this into this whole thing. And if it's a caricature, but the beauty of it was how many people thought it was real. The caricature in their head was so extreme that they couldn't separate it from this silly sort of parody. And that's the other part of it is that you go like, who's then responsible? Mm-hmm. You know, who's responsible? You know, is this guy created something that's very funny? And to some people would go, well, it just shows you how close to the truth it is. Like maybe, or shows you.
And that's funny. If you can bring back the Pixelated Boat response to it. The feeling when you parody a guy making up stuff about Trump, but people believe it, so you become part of the problem.
Well, that's the problem is you can't be responsible for other people being too gullible. Like if you're not trying to, he's not trying to trick anybody.
No. And his point was the point of his parody was he thought that Fire and Fury, which I think history has kind of borne out a little bit, that Michael Wolff, the author. Veracity was not his number one priority in writing that book. And I think that there is, as somebody who's read it in a political context, I think there's a lot of worth in Fire and Fury, specifically in understanding the structure of who leaks to who. But his point, Pixelated Boat, as an artist trying to parody, was like, this guy can make up anything and everyone would buy it. So he would make up the craziest thing, and then it winds up going viral as like, oh my God, you can't believe what happens in this book that not all of us have read yet.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's why the YouTube algorithm is weird.
Did you see the pen tweet at the top of Pixelated Boat?
This is a Donkey Kong comic strip.
Oh, yes.
Discourse Donkey Kong from pursuing discourage Donkey Kong from pursuing a literary career.
Ah, I'm writing a magical realist novel about a candle maker who befriends a haunted mandolin.
And the guy presses a button that says, criticize the ape's turgid prose.
Your words cut deep. Donkey Kong has dropped out of his MFA program. You win.
No, he is a hilarious comic artist, and I would highly recommend you follow him on Instagram. That is an all-time Instagram follow where he posts all of his comics. Very, very, very funny.
So we've solved it all, guys. We've solved it.
Well, I don't know. This maybe we should save this for after things, but we do talk a lot about Elon Musk on this show. Do we want to talk about the Elon Musk thing either here or on after things,
We'll do that after things.
We'll do it for after things.
I would say that I think that certainly we need to have when it comes to sort of the algorithms and like that is one. I think we need to have a better understanding of what's attainable presently, what is worthy of being attained, how these things work. You know, I think the part of it is that you get this, well, they should do this. Like, that would be great. They could do this. But doing that may not be as easy as we think it is, because it's like we should, you know, because people have solutions, but they haven't thought deeply about the problem, or and it hasn't maybe been explained to them, because I think even journalists don't understand it. They don't grasp it. And that's part of the problem, is that the people we look to explain things often are no more enlightened than we are.
I also think that, again, it's easy to forget, but I do believe that we are still in a very awkward adolescence with the internet, and so much new has happened and has radically shaped our world that we are finding ways to understand it. And part of that is, I would suspect, in 10 to 15 years that we will think differently about platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, mm-hmm. because I think that they're closer to the power company than they are a thing that, you know, everything needs to be answered for. And I think that that's somewhere where we're going to get to a point where we need to be able to criticize peer-to-peer on these networks. But I do think that there's a limit in what some of these platforms can do when the amount of volume of stuff is kind of coming in and everybody's priorities are different.
You know, I had a friend who was a very, very, very intelligent person, a media personality, and very smart, very, very, very smart person. And I would watch them get upset early days of the internet and feel like they had to respond to everything said about them. You know, somebody'd say something on a forum and they'd be like, I'm like, what are you doing? We need to go set this thing up. Like, oh no, I got to respond to this. Why? Because they said this. I'm like, who cares? I can't let it go unanswered. And I'd be like, I don't know if you realize how big the internet is. You don't think you want to spend your entire life going there, but he couldn't understand how big it was. And the fact that just trying to go into this one forum, this one place to argue with this one person was not going to solve it. And so I've watched very intelligent people fail to understand, you know, like, and everything that's in front of you is not everything in the world. You know, like, it's important to him. This must be a big deal because it's brought to his attention. But it's like, no, there are probably 1,000 other forums right now that are having conversations very similar to this. Yeah. And the more time you waste here, the less time you spend doing the things you should be doing.
I bet that there's like a human nature element to that. I'm sure. Mm. I especially in the past couple of weeks have been trying to disengage a lot of just like, okay, I saw that and I don't need to put my input in it, or mm-hmm. I disagree with this thing and I don't even need to let this person know that I disagree. I just am going to go right
by the way,
it.
I love the new look Bryce 2.0 fully gibberish Twitter account. Like it is great. I think it is just go ahead, give him a follow at Brycas, sure. on Twitter, BRYCAS.
Okay, so last night I did tweet out just every single non-verbal muttering I could think of in like a minute. But my Twitter has lately been a lot of like, here's a portmanteau I came up with, or here I photoshopped this game called Raft into the word fart, because I need it to be light, and I need to just disengage and not get, because that's the thing, especially on Twitter, you can get under, I'm easy to get under my skin, and I have, I don't know, I guess a sense of justice where I need to.
It's almost as if the content's designed for that.
What?
That it's designed to be less nuanced and more about drawing in clicks and retweets. And you know, one of the funniest things that I have seen is in my role as a political pundit, where I am now reading far more than I on purpose than I would even otherwise. I'm trying to keep in touch with not only my own personal political whims, but also a general zeitgeist. As you go to reddit.com/r/politics, right? Mm-hmm. And they have a very, very, very smart rule. Kudos to R Politics for having the rule. No changing the headline.
Oh.
So now if you have a headline, it's got to just be the headline, right? Seems like a great idea. Except for the fact that now the most popular things is just incentivizing the most salacious possible versions of the headlines.
Yeah.
So now you're they also have a whitelisted group of sites. So it's like, and it's fairly robust and it covers stuff from all ideological spectrums. But if, let's say, theoretically, I'm going to posit this, I don't have any scientific evidence, but let's say, for example, that maybe r/politics, the majority of the readers and voters are liberal. Mm-hmm. What you happen to get is just the most salacious liberal-leaning headlines that rise to the top.
Yeah.
And it shows you, look, that rule was there theoretically to get the most even-keeled stuff you could.
When in fact, what people did was what people choose to do, which is to bend around the rule to get what they want to do, which is to get a reaction and a rise out of people.
And it demonstrates that, look, these are uncertain times in the world of media, and everybody needs that click, and they want to get that click more than the site next to them.
Yeah.
In any way that you can metaphorically imagine, all sites physically being next to each other.
Yeah. It's like a street.
Yeah. Like a big, Silk Road.
Like a big super highway.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to do picks?
Sure.
I got a pick. This is a game that I think I've bought twice now because it's very good. And I think I had bought it on my 3DS, and I don't use my 3DS, so now I bought it on the Switch. It's SteamWorld Heist. You guys heard of SteamWorld Heist?
No.
So it is about these sort of steampunk-looking robots who are also cowboys. I think they're called cowbots, who travel through space and board other ships and fight and steal and get loot from the poor bastards who end up on the other side of the ships. And it's, if you've ever played something like XCOM or something that is tactical but not too systems heavy, SteamWorld Heist is very much in that vein. And it's also 2D, which is an interesting take on a tactics game. And I think it works generally really well. You still have cover, but you're also manually aiming your shots. So some of your guns have like laser sights, so you'll see where the bullets will go, but some of them you don't. You have to account for recoil. It's really cool, and it's a really good portable or Switch game because you can, the missions are very short, and you can always just, you know, pause and suspend and come back to it at any time. So that's something that I've gotten back into, which is SteamWorld Heist.
My pick is Legion.
Oh.
Legion is a television show on the FX channel. It can be downloaded on many different platforms. I love this show for a couple reasons. Number one, the actors are fantastic. You always love to spend time with them. Number two, Noah Hawley continues to kind of announce himself as one of just the most amazing creative forces to watch going today. He's obviously prolific considering that he's, you know, juggling this and Fargo. And this is no small, you know, the amount of effort put into each and every episode just kind of makes everything else on television sort of pale in comparison visually.
Yeah.
but it's also just a great X-Men story. And it kind of reminds you that the X-Men movies that we get are always, because Wolverine's the most popular character, they tend to be very action-adventure-y sort of stories, with the most that we ever get in the psychic element of it is usually almost defined by the boundaries of how far Professor X or Jean Grey can do it, and everybody's wearing helmets just so you can keep it away and doesn't just invalidate the plot. Mm-hmm. Or Cerebro, because every X-Men movie on some point revolves around who's going to go into Cerebro and whether or not Cerebro is going to work. But Legion dares to ask the question in both seasons, and this one I think specifically, what if we had no restrictions and we just had multiple characters that have these fantastic psychic powers? What kind of story can we tell and how should we illustrate it? And man, I just can't speak highly enough of how much I love season two of Legion.
Yeah, I don't keep up with it every week because we aren't watching it on Spoiler in Time right now. And so every time I sit down to watch an episode or two, I'm like, yeah, this is a really incredible show. Like, they really go out of their way to try to make every bit of it feel bespoke, you know?
Oh, yeah. And look, there are, you know, some of the episodes are bottle episodes, and they certainly take enough time sometimes for, you know, what I assume is Noah Lowley or the writer's room's personal missives on, you know, life and philosophy as narrated by John Hamm. Mm-hmm. But in general, like, there's just a great superhero story in this. And it just shows you that it doesn't all have to be, you know, like that. Those first two seasons of Daredevil I really liked because it was like punch, kick, chop, sake, you know, but that's what that character is. That's what Luke Cage is. That's not every superhero, you know? Yeah. And it's what I liked about Doctor Strange. Doctor Strange ended the way that it did. And it's what I love the most about Legion. It's like, hey, look, here's a story about psychics and stuff like that, but it just takes it to the wildest extremes instead of trying to figure out, like, another show that's currently airing, as soon as somebody gets psychic powers, how we can immediately define where the gates are, you know? Well, because we can't think of anywhere interesting to take somebody with unlimited powers.
And I think the more that superhero or comic book character media can get out of being action-y, just, you know, it's who are we punching this week? Like, the further we can get out of that and try to explore other interesting parts of these worlds, or worlds that are just filled with superheroes, I think the better off the genre will be, because there's space for all of it.
The other thing about Legion is that I think there's maybe like one human character. Like, everybody else is a mutant. So it's not necessarily about, you know, like, oh, are we scared? Are we super beings? Like, there's like talks about the world, right? But in general, this is all a bunch of superpowered people just having a story amongst themselves, which is rad.
And I like that the X-Men stuff is very a very light touch. I don't know a lot of X-Men stuff, and I really enjoy Legion. And I think I wouldn't enjoy it as much as if I knew, or if there was more X-Men ties to it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's stuff if you want to see it. There are references to larger things, but it doesn't beat you over the head. And at some point, I'm sure there'll be somebody that, you know, wheels their ass out, and you'll be like really excited that they're there, but it's not the point of the story.
Wheels. Okay. Let's see where you're going.
I got a pick.
What you got?
And it comes with, you know, a number of caveats, but.
Okay. Classic if pick.
Uh-oh.
He got the thing.
I finally got the Lenovo Mirage Solo, right? Okay. It's on me. Nothing better than watching somebody play VR, right?
You'll notice
in front, there are the two cameras. So what the two cameras do, that gives it what's called rolled sense. And that is what enables it to, let me just get out of Blade Runner Revelations where it's very loud.
Sure.
What that does is it gives you 6 degrees of freedom. So that means that I can move my head around, track, I can go up and down. you know, at the Vive, you've got to have the lighthouse, those different things to bounce back at you. This does not need this. Mm-hmm. This is completely self-contained as far as being able to track the headset all around. So I can walk a few feet forward. I can look around objects, etc. Now, all the games in here are limited to how far you're able to move because they don't want you like walking into a sofa or tripping and then suing them or something.
Yeah.
It's got very good tracking. The refresh rate's pretty good. It's not as good of a refresh rate as, let's say, what you're going to get with a brand new Oculus or Vive, but it's $400, completely self-contained. The controller, if I were to say the weakest point would be compared to like a desktop system, like you don't need a PC or anything. You just put that thing on. Very limited number of games. Very, very limited number. But if you want to have that 6 degrees of freedom, it's cool. The other limitation is the controller. And so it's like a laser pointer. It points around. It does not move positionally in space like the Oculus or the Vive controllers do. So that's a limitation. But we're at that moment, though, where, you know, a $400 device has that tracking built into it, is able to have two cameras to track, move you around, etc. is pretty amazing. I wouldn't run out and buy it unless I was like super, super curious to play around with some 3D and wanted that experience. Mm-hmm. I think the $200 Oculus Go is cool, but it doesn't have that 6 degree of freedom. And there's a world of difference between the two of them. Also, you've got to adjust the head just right. When I first did this, my head hurt for an hour afterwards because I had it too tight.
Glad it was just that. Because when I had initially talked to you and you were like, my head hurt for an hour, I'm like, oh, geez, I hope it's not like a refresh rate thing or that's like a migraine machine.
No, like literally like the bridge of my nose physically hurt from that.
Gotcha.
So I'm more excited about what this means. You know, a year from now, and if, you know, if nobody's burning to like, oh, I got to do VR now, you know, a year from now, it's going to be great. But this... We talked about on this on the podcast previously about the growth rate of VR, and you can track where the hardware will be based upon how LCD screens are improving in size and the processors inside of there, what they're able to be able to handle. Mm-hmm. Next year, you're going to be moving up to like the $400 device is going to have probably 2K displays for each eye. It's going to have a much better processor. It's going to probably have a better tracker that'll be able to be positional in space. And I think that's where we're going to get closer to the thing that's going to be really cool.
Yeah, so. I mean – you know, so this is built on like Daydream, right? So this uses all the Google VR ecosystem apps. I mean, imagine there's been the rumors of, oh, Apple is making a VR, you know, device. And we've seen, you know, how powerful mobile chips have gotten year over year or every couple of years. And it would not be very long until we have a mobile chip that is on par with something like PlayStation 4, which has its own VR suite of high demand games.
Yeah, you can see where Apple's going with this, what Apple's been doing with their own AR kit and what they're doing at their own, they're building their own processes for stuff. But, you know, Google's not complacent either. You know, Google had a hardware intensive system for trying to do tracking and stuff. And then Apple came out with AR kit and then Google came out with their own AR
tool core. Is that
right? Yeah, AR Core, yeah. And said, hey, and Apple processors are very good at certain things like that that make them probably give them the edge and may increase that. But, you know, if something that gives you just as good of an experience is only 8 months behind, then great. Everything moves forward. So it's exciting. So, yeah, people are putting a ton of effort into it.
Very cool.
And that's if you want, try it.
And I like that this Mirage has Daydream in it compared to the Oculus Go, which has its own subset of apps. It doesn't work with the Rift apps, where the Daydream seems like it would be a viable alternative marketplace for
mobile-based apps. Yeah, in both of them, though, you're kind of going like, all right, like, what is there? Sure. You know, what content is there? And you're kind of left a little bit...
underwhelmed.
Know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, gentlemen. Without Brian here. It's been awesome. I'm kidding. It's terrible.
Oh.
It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.